The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for April the 28th. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up on this week's podcast, engineering life, but at what cost? We discard the hyperbole and discuss the very real future and potential societal impacts of synthetic biology. Also in the show...
If it weren't for the role that religions have played over the last two millennia, the very expensive and fragile institution of science could never have developed. But I don't think we need it anymore. We can be grateful to religion for music and art as well.
Philosopher Dan Dennett explains why he thinks religion is an affront to rationality. Plus, the bionic eye that's helping blind people see again. And we'll discover why Macclesfield's favourite soft rock radio station is leading a campaign to save one of Britain's most iconic telescopes. Take my hand, we'll make it, I swear. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Like London buses, you wait a week for members of the Science Weekly pod squad to turn up, and then three of them come along at once. James Randerson is the Guardian science correspondent. James, you don't believe in public transport, do you?
I don't believe in many things.
It's true. Nell Bowes from the Guardian's arts team, you're also a keen cyclist, I hear.
Indeed, not a trick one.
And back from 6 weeks in the Costa Rican jungle, looking more like Daniel Craig than ever before, it's the very suntanned Ian Sample.
No, from one bunch of monkeys to another, really, isn't it?
Good. We'll listen to your tales of monkeys later. Right, we're going to start this week with synthetic biology. It's a subject we've obviously covered before, and one name which crops up time and time again is that of a certain J. Craig Venter. But we're going to cast him aside this week as we endeavour to go beyond the hype and the headlines about creating artificial life forms. Last week, biologists, physicists and chemists from around the UK met in London to discuss the future of what is unquestionably one of the most exciting fields in modern science today. We'll hear about the potential society impacts later, but first let's start with the basics. Here's Philippe Holliger. He's programme leader at the Medical Research Council Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge.
Well, synthetic biology really concerns itself with building, designing and synthesizing biological systems or biologically inspired systems with a view to recapitulate behaviors that we see in nature and hopefully go beyond that. It's a little bit like learning about the clock. Rather than taking it apart and studying it, it's the little wheels. Synthetic biologists would argue that you learn more about how a clock works by trying to build a clock from scratch using similar parts. Now, some of the applications that have already been realized with synthetic biology concern reassortment of genetic parts, genes, pathways, and so forth from different organisms to create new functions, new properties in cells. One of these is if you want a sort of programmable behavior.
And so in that sense, you're programming these cells to find tumors and kill them. Would you be able to program them for different tumors? How would this, if this worked in practice, how would it affect the life of a patient?
I think one should generally think of this as a cellular behavior that could be programmed in a sort of simple if this happens, do this way. Obviously, the hope is that such programmed cells would allow completely new therapeutic strategies, such as having some sort of search and destroy vehicle patrolling the bloodstream, finding tumor cells and eliminating them. Likewise, if such genetic programs could be engineered or integrated into stem cells, one could think of functions that would allow tissue regeneration, where cells would recognize if they have found the right place and would start to grow to reconstitute the liver or, you know, whatever tissue you would like to replace.
You also mentioned in your talk the production of drugs, new drugs. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes. This is particularly attractive for drugs that derive from natural products, because these usually have very complex three-dimensional structures which are difficult and expensive to synthesize with conventional chemistry. But by reconfiguring the metabolic pathways and synthesis pathways in the cell in the right way, we can make those products in cells in much larger amounts. The best example today is artemisinin, which is a complex drug isolated from sweet wormwood, which is very effective against malaria, but has been very expensive to synthesize by conventional chemistry, but can now be produced in bacterial cells in high yields and much more economically, simply by rearranging the metabolic pathways from two different organisms, from E. coli and from baker's yeast.
A lot of the applications that we've discussed and also that the people are working on seem to be kind of engineering type things. It's an engineering scale process. Does the practice of engineering have anything to tell you, and is there any way that it guides this new field of synthetic biology?
Synthetic biology definitively benefits from some of the principles that have been successful in the engineering disciplines, such as trying to analyze complex systems as a hierarchy of parts, devices, systems, and so forth, and to look at individual components at the level of abstraction and standardization. However, I think there is still a lot to learn about how biological systems interact, so we must not get carried away and think we can. There will be off-the-shelf parts which can be assembled in the same way as they can with electronic components. So there is still a lot to learn before we arrive at this. But I think it definitively helps the planning of experiments and how one would break down complex systems into more manageable subsystems.
Philippe Holliger there from the MRC's Molecular Biology Lab. Pod, let me open this up to you. Craig Venter seems to get all the headlines in this particular area, you know, creating life, all that sort of stuff. But there's quite a bit more going on. Ian, can you sort of run through maybe one or two of the other things?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think Venter does get an awful lot of the headlines just because, not least because he has such a sort of a brilliant PR gene inside him, I think, as well. You know, and he's got some of the best scientists on board. But there are scientists at University of Maryland who are doing a very similar thing by trying to create what would be original organisms by putting a created genome into bacteria and booting it up, if you like. So that would give you your sort of a synthetic life form, just like Venter's trying to do. We've also got scientists who are trying to create essentially circuitry from genetic components, which I think could be really interesting, just building these circuits from the bottom up. And also people are toying with artificial chromosomes even to see what characteristics they might be able to get from those. So it seems at the moment everybody is trying to produce a lot of these kind of basic components that you'd almost have sort of on the shelf, which you can then use to try and build all manner of different things. And I think there, people are only really going to be limited by imagination.
One of the things that Philippe Holliger also mentioned was to address this issue of what happens if one of these artificial organisms sort of makes it out into the wild. People are worried, you know, they're going to take over the world or something. And he had quite a nice phrase, which was that these things can only really survive in the cozy confines of the lab. As soon as they get out anywhere, they just die straight away because they've got they just can't compete with any wild bacteria. So not too much, we hope, to worry about there. Okay, well, look, we're going to talk a bit more about the societal impacts of all of this a bit later in the show. For now, though, it's probably wise for me to say you can find out loads more of this stuff at guardian.co.uk/science. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, that colossus of contemporary American philosophy, Daniel Dennett, tells us why religion is an affront to science. And we'll hear what you thought about our discussion on creationism too. Plus, soft rock and the solar system. We'll find out about the local radio station trying to save one of Britain's most iconic scientific landmarks. It's all coming up, of course, but first, here's a pick of the other science news making headlines in the past 7 days. This is Nell and James with your News Jam.
News Jam.
Scientists hunting an invisible form of matter that pervades the universe and holds galaxies together claim to have found it underneath a mountain in Italy. The discovery at a laboratory built deep into the Gran Sasso mountain in Abruzzo could end a 70-year race to find the elusive dark matter that physicists believe accounts for 90% of the mass of the universe.
More than half of blood transfusions may do more harm than good, with some patients facing a six-fold greater risk of dying following surgery because of transfusions, doctors have warned. Fears over the safety of blood transfusions have prompted some physicians to recommend that they are used as a last resort, with hospitals urged to be more selective over which patients receive blood. Scientists suspect that aging blood that has been stored before being given to patients is less able to carry oxygen to vital organs and causes damage to the immune system.
Surgeons have fitted bionic eyes to two men in their 50s to partially restore their eyesight. They are the first in Britain to have the artificial retinas fitted. Both are completely blind, but will now be able to walk around unaided and identify simple objects. If the trial is successful, the £15,000 retinas could be approved for general use within 3 years.
And finally, the seemingly harmless visitors to your garden bird table have a more fearsome past than you might think. By analysing proteins taken from fossils, scientists have confirmed that our modern-day feathered friends share a close ancestry with Tyrannosaurus rex. The molecular sequencing technique also showed that the fearsome dino is more closely related to chickens and ostriches than it is to the alligator or the anolis lizard.
Thank you, Nell and James. Ian, let's talk about the dark matter thing. Now, I don't actually believe that they lifted up this mountain and found the axion sitting there underneath. There must have been something more complicated than that, right?
As far as I know, all of the dark matter experiments, all the experiments which are looking for dark matter, which is this substance named so because it doesn't reflect or emit light, so it's practically, to all intents, invisible to us. All of the detectors for it are based underground in Britain. The detector is based at about a kilometre underground in an old salt mine in Yorkshire. And the reason they're put underground is that there are other particles that will be flying around the universe, cosmic rays and such like, which could actually smother the signals from dark matter because the signals are only going to be incredibly weak. So they basically hide these things through enormous amounts of rock and see if they can detect a characteristic signature of dark matter with the detectors. And the interesting thing about this detector, which is under this huge mountain in Gran Sasso mountain, is that it actually looks for dark matter as the Earth basically flies through the universe. So as the Earth orbits the Sun, it should pick up dark matter in the universe as it zooms around. It actually finds should have a peak of its signal exactly on June the 2nd and a weaker signal around December. So by looking at the detection rates over a number of years, you should be able to pick up a fluctuation in the signal. It's interesting that this group actually came out with a result that they thought they had found dark matter about 10 years ago now, and everyone thought, no, don't believe it. And now what they've done is they've come back with a heck of a lot more data, and they've said, look, this isn't a statistical fluke. We think this is a real signal. It still only comes from one group, so a lot of scientists aren't going to be jumping up and down yet, but you know, it's interesting.
But is everyone else believing at this time? Are they more likely to think it is?
What's really tricky about it is, first of all, you have the problem is that it's only one lab who are saying this, and there are a lot of people looking for dark matter, so you'd expect others to have found it as well. The second thing is that, as you well know, there are an enormous number of candidates for dark matter. It could be all manner of different postulated particles could constitute dark matter. It may even be a whole bunch of them. Now, the signal they've got doesn't really fit any of these perfectly. It could be a particle called an axion. It could be a particle called a neutralino. It may be something in between. It doesn't quite fit any of them, though.
Let's move on to something else.
Don't say that properly, because I just spluttered and
it's fine. Why don't you talk about bionic eyes instead? You mentioned this on Guardian Daily a few days ago, so you don't need to go into huge amounts of detail. But tell us really, really quickly what the guys at Moorfields did. And then also there's some interesting new research that's going on with gene therapy trials.
The research at Moorfields, Moorfields is involved in both of these projects, but the one we reported last week was that that surgeons there have fitted what everybody couldn't resist but call bionic eyes to two 50-odd-year-old men. They're essentially artificial retinas, which are basically electrodes which they attach to the back of the retina. And it uses the system uses a camera mounted on a pair of glasses to basically beam video images to the electrodes, which then pass those images through to the optic nerve. And it works for a condition whereby the actual light-sensitive cells in the retina have died out. So if you can then replace that with this sort of electronics,
stimulate them artificially.
Yeah, exactly. The rest of the brain structure and the optic nerve is still intact, so you can actually use those. So it doesn't give them proper vision, though. Let's be clear about that.
No. And these are men who had lost their sight at some point during their sight, not people who were born blind. Presumably this wouldn't work.
Yeah, this isn't people who were born blind. That's right. This is people who have had retinal disease called retinitis pigmentosa, which gradually destroys part of the retina.
And how many pixels are there in this eye?
On this one, it's very small if you think about what sort of resolution you have with a healthy eye. I mean, this is a 6x10 grid, essentially, that you see. And so you have to think that with one eye, because these operations only involved one eye, you would just be able to see lights on or off in a 6x10 grid, and you'd have to then try and use that to interpret where something was, where a microphone was in front of you, where a table was, where a knife and fork might be. It's a task.
Let me move you on then, Ian, to the next piece of this research. Well, not this research, but another bit of research looking at how to restore sight. This is a bit more of a gene therapy trial, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, last night we heard that there was the first results came out of the world's first clinical trial of a gene therapy for a very rare childhood blindness. It's been really interesting. The trial, at this stage, it's a report of only 3 people, but it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, very sort of well-respected journal. And especially one of the patients had a really interesting recovery in that they tested this guy who's an 18-year-old guy who had a pretty seriously advanced disease. I mean, his sight was very, very poor. He wasn't completely blind, but it was very poor. And they videoed him trying to navigate a maze that they had set up in fairly dim light. And he took more than a minute getting through it, and he needed an awful lot of help. And he bumped into a heck of a lot of stuff on the way. And 6 months after having the gene therapy, he went through it in seconds as quickly as someone who was able-sighted. And it was, he can't see perfectly. He can't see much better than before, but he can see better. And it's the first results from a trial like this, and it's he's done well.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
One more thing before we wrap up. Now, Silk FM, the Macclesfield's premier rock station, is launching a campaign to save Jodrell Bank, the famous radio telescope up there. They've even produced a song. Now, guys, do you want to hear this? Have you heard it, in fact?
Certainly.
Yeah, I want to hear it.
You want to hear it, don't you?
Yeah,
okay,
definitely.
Well, here it is.
Never before has a tourist attraction provoked such a strong reaction.
From miles around, the people come. Our big dish sticks out like a sore thumb.
Looking at the stars for 51 years. If it disappears, we'd all shed tears. Just because we can't find any green men, we have to look again and again.
It's Jodrell, Jodrell. It's Jodrell.
What do you think of this song? Is it going to win awards? What do you think? Is it going to persuade you, first of all, to
scan?
No, but first of all, are you going to donate to the Jodrell Bank?
Will you tell us more about the Jodrell Bank? Why is it?
Well, essentially, it's one of the problems that faced by the Science and Technology Facilities Council. It's got an £80 million budget deficit, and it's all very boring, and they're pulling out of lots and lots of projects, including the International Linear Collider and stuff. We've talked about that before, but Jodrell Bank seems to be one of the projects that they're probably going to pull out of as well, which is such a shame. It's like £2.5 million a year. It inspired huge generations of astronomers up north in Manchester.
I have to say, after that, I don't have much hope for it.
What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, really.
Isn't it nice, though, that people have got together to do this?
I suppose. Who actually
bastard.
Put it together?
Who? What?
I mean, who put it together? Is it like the radio,
it's Silk
the crazy
FM,
kids?
It's the Silk FM, the in Macclesfield's greatest soft rock station.
They're local, their DJs did it.
Yes.
We're always asking people to get more involved in science and things like that. Look, yeah, they come up with it.
Okay, yes. Yeah. No, you're right.
I'd like to point out that Silk FM are actually part of the Guardian Media Group radio station.
Are they really not? No way.
They are indeed.
That's fantastic.
I was going to say purely independently, because I had no idea that that was true, that I wanted to hate that so much, but I love it.
You do love it, don't you?
I do love it.
There's more details on our blog, of course, and you can even, there's a link to the YouTube video of the song, which is superb because it's very Dylan-esque.
They've got a music video.
We've got a music video, and it's Dylan-esque, it's funny, it's great. I love it.
It's kind of strange that it's being, they were calling it a tourist attraction.
It is essentially a tourist attraction, as well as a high-class research place.
Oh, right, okay, fine. Great.
You've not been to the North of England, have you, James? You posh bastard.
Yes, that's
right, well, we're going to leave that there. To have your say on any of this stuff, head to the Science blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post something on the Facebook wall. Now, if you're listening to this on Monday, you'll be exactly 3 days into the Guardian's magnificent science course, yours for free with a bargain 80 pence newspaper every day this week. We heard a few choice extracts from these supplements last week, and quite frankly, because she has the best voice in the pod, here's Nell with another. These are the musings of astronomer Royal Martin Rees. He's talking about the differences between humans and aliens and how it'll be science that brings us all together.
If we ever established contact with intelligent life on another world, there would be barriers to communication. First, they would be many light years away, so signals would take many years to reach them. There'd be no scope for quick repartee. There might be an IQ gap, but there would not be an unbridgeable culture gap. One common culture, in addition to mathematics, would be physics and astronomy. The aliens may live on planet Zog and have seven tentacles, but they would be made of similar atoms to us. And like us, they could trace their origins back to the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. They would share with us the potentialities of a perhaps infinite future.
Science Weekly.
2 weeks ago, we interviewed Ken Ham from the creationist group Answers in Genesis. Soon afterwards, Keir Mottram, who probably lives a very disgusted life in Tunbridge Wells, sent us this email.
Dear Sir, why do you send a science correspondent to report on an event that is not scientific, indeed explicitly rejects the scientific method? Why do you then print a subsequent article on that event? And why do you include it on the homepage of the Guardian website in a section headed explicitly Science and Environment? Ken Ham is not a scientist. His faith is non-scientific. His belief in creationism is anti-scientific. Why do you give him and his nonsense an undeserved credibility, which he and his followers will unquestionably seek to capitalise on, by using the science resources on your newspaper to report on his activities? Have you no shame? No backbone? Does a cultural relativist whatever now pervade every single section of what was once a great newspaper? I'm disgusted.
Well, that learned us. James, you got anything to say in your defence?
I do, actually. And, Keir and I have been having a bit of an email conversation. He's a very nice man, actually. And
he's a very angry man. He's probably your type, isn't he?
He's less angry now than when we started the conversation, I think it's fair to say. Yeah, I think there are two issues here. There's one is should a science correspondent cover this issue? And the second one is, should we just leave this guy alone, you know, not give him any credibility? And, you know, I'd argue that, you know, he's trying to attack science, the scientific method, scientific understanding, etc., etc. And so it is right for a science correspondent to cover what he has to say. The question about whether we should even give him any credibility at all by having him in the newspaper, well, you know, he does have a very wealthy organisation in the US and a large, expensive museum which lots of people go to. And the fact that he's over here, I think, is putting out his message is interesting.
He's going to get coverage anyway, so someone has to sort of step up and say something against it. Otherwise, you know, he'll just be left unchallenged.
I agree. And I think our coverage, it was pretty clear where we stood on the issue. But to be honest, at the end of the day, you know, give this guy enough rope and he hangs himself, really.
Well, Keir, consider the next section specifically for you. Last week, The Guardian hosted a debate between fertility expert Professor Robert Winston and the philosopher Daniel Dennett. The motion they were arguing about was, is religion a threat to rationality and science? And this was Dan Dennett's opening gambit.
I think a good case can be made that if it weren't for religion, we wouldn't have science in the first place. If it weren't for the role that religions have played over the last two millennia, providing relatively secure and stable and cooperative societies, the very expensive and fragile institution of science could never have developed. So we can be very grateful to religion for providing that ladder that we could climb. But I don't think we need it anymore. We can be grateful to religion for music and art as well. But I don't think we need that ladder anymore. What we should do, I think, is not try to extirpate religion. I'm not an abolitionist. We should allow religions to recede in both moral and political power. Their moral authority should be seen to be diminished. And I propose that if we will just criticize the excesses of religion fairly and openly, people will either have to fix it or forget it. And it will gradually take on a benign form when it will not be a problem for anybody, and those that love it will be able to love it. And it will deserve to be loved because it will not be any longer a danger. Now, the question, religion is the greatest threat to scientific progress. Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe it isn't. If it isn't, well, then what is? When I thought about this, I thought, well, maybe alcohol, or maybe television, or maybe addictive video games. Those three scourges can cloud the mind and disturb one's critical faculties, the way religion does. But only religion has this extra fillip. It doesn't just disable, it honors the disability. People are revered for the fact that they managed to live their life in a dream world, setting aside factual knowledge and making the major decisions of their lives on the basis of what voices tell them that they inculcate by indulging in rituals that basically intoxicate them. Now, I think that's got to change. When I was young, our attitude towards drunk drivers was very different from what it is today. In general, oh, that poor fellow, he was drunk. But of course, he didn't really have his wits about him at the time, so we don't hold him fully responsible. People were, in effect, excused for some of their mayhem because, you know, poor fellow, he was drunk. Now, I'm happy to say we've inverted that attitude. We hold drunk drivers doubly culpable because they're responsible for having put themselves in that irresponsible condition in the first place. And I think that same inversion is called for in the case of religion. That is to say, when passionate individuals, motivated by their religious passion, engage in destructive behavior, we should not honor that, we should not revere that, we should consider that shameful. Not only should we consider it shameful, those who abet it, the preachers and the apologists of religious zeal, should be held accountable in the same way that today we hold negligent hosts or bartenders responsible if they unleash drunk drivers on the roads.
Daniel Dennett there, director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University in New York. James, you actually were sitting between Daniel Dennett and Robert Winston at that debate, an impressive array of facial hair there. tell us what Robert Winston had to say to that sort of attack by Dennett. Okay. Softly spoken attack, I must say.
It was, yeah, very eloquent and calm attack. Well, Winston's point really is that the biggest enemy of rationality in science, which was kind of the point of the debate, is not religion, it's certainty. So he's saying, you know, certainty either in religion or in science, where people sort of say, you know, I know, I'm absolutely sure that, you know, evolution happened in this way or whatever it might be. That is the true enemy of rationality and science, which is an important point, but, you know, one might argue easy to refute in that that's not really the way that science should be done.
Absolutely,
or conducted.
Yeah. And
but
nearly every scientific paper you ever read has maybes, could-bes, possiblys all over it. It's all statistics anyway. I mean, who's saying that scientists want to be certain about anything?
But I think you're talking, isn't he talking about the certainty of people like Dawkins and in their kind of rather polemical arguments rather than the lack of certainty in scientific papers?
I think he was, because and he actually said, I asked him specifically, do you think Dawkins is a fundamentalist atheist? And he said yes, which Dawkins himself denies, because he says, you know, that's a complete misunderstanding of the word fundamentalist. But anyway, the audience were quite lively as well. And another thing that Winston said, which I thought was quite interesting, someone said to him, isn't it the case that most of the wars that have happened are due to religion? And he actually made quite a convincing kind of demolition of that point by going through recent wars and saying, you know, First World War, Second World War, nothing to do with religion. Even some conflicts that look like they're to do with religion, when you get down to the nitty-gritty, like the, I think this is a harder argument to make, but anyway, he was trying to make it that the Palestinian conflict with Israel is not really about religion, it's about access to resources and poverty, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway,
I don't know, there's something I didn't that hold true with me with that argument. I mean, he did, I think, a fairly good job of pointing out that the religion isn't the cause for every war. But the Israel-Palestine conflict, for example, or the Crusades, he even mentioned at some point. I don't know if that's true that it was just about poverty. I mean, essentially, whatever war you have, it's about power of some sort. And sometimes it's executed via a religion. That's how you exercise power. And when Winston was saying that this is all about poverty and resource, well, I mean, that's the way you then make people angry about that is to sort of commandeer them into a particular way of thinking. It's and say that our religion or our way of thinking is going to get you out of this poverty. Ultimately, it's all about, all wars and things are about poverty and power, and I think religion just plays on that. Nell, you've got a question.
Yeah, I was interested in Dennett's idea that we either fix it or forget it with religion and it'll gradually fade away into benign form. Did anyone take him up on that?
Not really, actually. No. That didn't come out much.
What was
in
the crowd
debate.
Like? I mean, what were they? Did they? Which side did they go with?
Well, We had a straw poll at the beginning and one at the end. And at the beginning, maybe half of them were undecided, but there was a majority in favour of Winston's position, which is that religion is not the primary enemy of rationalism and science. And by the end of the debate, more people had made up their mind, but still more people were in favour of Winston's position. And I don't think it was because, you know, the entire audience was full of God-fearing types. I think it was more, I don't know, my impression was that people were actually saying, well, religion might be an enemy of science, but it's not the most important one.
James, thanks very much. We've posted a link to the text versions of both Dan Dennett and Lord Winston's arguments on our website. Have a read and post your comments there. It's almost time for us to depart into the stratosphere once more, or just press stop on the recorder, whichever's easiest. Before we do, though, let's head back to our main topic this week, synthetic biology. We heard earlier about the science and engineering involved and some of the medical benefits that scientists hope to achieve. But what about the societal impacts of this research? Brian Wynne is the Professor of Science Studies at the University of Lancaster. He's leading a team looking at the sociological and economic aspects of genomics. He told me it's not just the responsibility of scientists to engage the public in this matter.
A lot of scientists, when you talk to them individually, express a lot of concern about, for example, the rate at which science is being expected to generate economic and technological outcomes of all kinds for UK PLC, and they've got the Treasury on the backs of the research councils, etc., etc. A lot of individuals will express concerns of that kind, but they don't have a forum where they can actually articulate those concerns collectively and have it fed back into, you know, the institutional science policy world. And I think that's the problem, really. It's not that individuals don't think about the social implications at all. They do. Most of them do, anyway. It's just, where does that lead? You know, and where are the fora where they can actually share those concerns and actually articulate?
Whenever you hear synthetic biologists talking, or engineers and so on, talking about the potential of this, it's always about cures and what the results are going to be. So in that sense, they are. It seems that scientists are focused on that side of things. I mean, perhaps they should be. Is that always the best way to move this stuff forward?
Yeah, good, very good question. I mean, I'm tempted to propose a moratorium on promise around scientific research programs. Of course, you know, it's quite right. Science thrives on imagination, and it's meant to be a creative enterprise. So imagining where this might lead is clearly an important part of just being a scientist. But there is a question about the extent to which the need or the pressure to actually produce extravagant promises is being intensified and escalated by the commercial competitive world in which scientists nowadays are increasingly having to operate. So there's a structural kind of wider issue which is generating that sort of pressure to promise, if you like, and what we call the political economy of promise. You know, you have to do it to get the investment, and you have to get the investment to do the science. You know, so it's a kind of self-referential circular world, really. The problem then is, what about past promises that have been made of the kind equivalent to the ones that are being made today about the future? And you can see that many of those promises didn't materialise. So the question is, what's going to happen with these ones? And are we basing science policy on fiction, which strikes as a rather kind of perverse thing to do when science is supposed to be about evidence, you know? So I do think we need to work out ways of making that kind of world of promise a bit more accountable, maybe a bit more open to evidence-based testing as well, for that matter.
But predicting any technology is always difficult. I mean, how do you do that without overburdening every scientist with huge amounts of paperwork and testing and so on?
That's a nightmare. But, you know, as I said in the meeting today, risk assessment, because of the way in which this field and related fields of science is going, risk assessment is basically redundant almost. It doesn't mean to say we shouldn't try and do it, of course, but we should be really aware and have our eyes open about the extent to which most of the future things coming out of fields like synthetic biology are not predictable. So that we've got to have a much more kind of iterative process, if you like, a more responsive mode of doing the debate and the regulatory decision-making about these kinds of fields, because we can't pretend to predict what the significant consequences are that we should then be assessing for risk and everything else.
From what you're saying, are you suggesting that perhaps that we should slow down on this research, or that it should, parts of it should be stopped altogether? Do you think there is, if members of the public knew exactly what was going on, that they'd say, hang on, stop?
Well, not necessarily, no. I think that the public is usually a lot more grown up about these things than they're given credit for. So just because there might be uncertainty surrounding something does not mean that people are going to say, oh, uncertainty, I'm scared of uncertainty, stop it, close it down. Ordinary people are not typically like that at all. They're perfectly aware of and used to dealing with uncertainties and things that they can't control. And often the problem is that the scientists are not ready to admit, they'll talk about uncertainties, but they're not ready to admit things which they can't control.
Brian Wynne there from the University of Lancaster. OK, it's time to wrap up this merry rabble. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science for links to all the stories we've discussed in the show. And if there's anything you're desperate to tell us, post a comment on our Facebook wall. My thanks, as ever, to James Randerson, Nell Bowes and the sun-kissed Daniel Craig, Ian Sample. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I'm Alok Jha, and if I sounded a bit sluggish today, it's because producer Ben forced me to eat the world's biggest burrito at lunchtime. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.